Today, on the exam room.
It was pretty shocking. I had a 2.5-year-old daughter, and basically this came out of nowhere. I woke up one morning and I had just had immense pain. I knew something was wrong. We dropped our daughter off at daycare, and my wife and I just went directly to the emergency room. And within an hour, I had a diagnosis.
How long did it take to rehab? Do you feel like you're pretty well back to normal?
Yes. I am in 100% the best shape of my entire life. Today, I am in the best shape of my life. And it started from that bed. When I was in the hospital, I told my wife, I am going to do the New York City Marathon. As soon as I get out of here, I'm doing the New York City Marathon.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world in great cities like Greenwich Village, New York, Pomona, California, and West Yorkshire, England. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 24 of season 7, number 523 overall. Robert Klein is our guest today, a gentleman who came face to face with his own mortality. As a young man in the prime of his life, Robert was suddenly told he had testicular cancer. It was a frightening diagnosis that would lead to one of the most painful surgeries you can imagine and a lengthy road to recovery. This was not the life that he wanted. He knew that changes needed to be made. And boy, were they. And so today on the show, we are getting into this gentleman's journey and how this pizza and steak aficionado from New York overhauled his life and his diet to become known as Broccoli Rob. Robert Klein is here with us to share his improbable journey back to health and why he credits a plant-based diet for helping keep his cancer in remission for 6 years and counting. And he's also going to take us inside the operating room that day and the invasive procedure that helped to save his life. And of course, the months-long, excruciatingly painful journey back to health that followed, including the ultra-radical diet he initially had to follow to a T. But today, Rob is back on his feet, fulfilling a promise he made to himself and his wife to run the New York City Marathon, and he is eating a beautiful diet to fuel him up. And he's also inspiring so many in the fight to keep going against cancer. He's going to share some inspiration and wisdom with us, including, for everyone, how to order the perfect vegan pizza. And yeah, these rules apply whether you're living in a small town or the pizza capital of the world. But before we link up with Rob, a couple of big life tapings to tell you about. First, March 26th in Washington, D.C. Of course, we're talking about the Power Foods Revolution with Dr. Neil Barnard, Chef Dustin Harder, Stephanie Ignafo, and myself at the National Press Club. Tickets on sale right now, pcrm.org/events. There's also a link in the episode notes. And everyone who gets a ticket that night also receives a copy of Dr. Barnard's new book, The Power Foods Diet. And just a few nights earlier, on Saturday, March 23rd, at the Enercare Center in Toronto, I'm going to be going one-on-one with Dr. Michael Greger, talking about unlocking longevity and his new book, How Not to Age. Then I'll also be sticking around the next day to speak at the Planted Expo at the same arena. Cannot wait to be back in Toronto. Head over to plantedlife.com or click the link in the episode notes for tickets. But right now, strap in for inspiration and one heck of a ride. Robert Broccoli Rob Klein joins us on the exam room. My friend, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Chuck. Glad to be here.
I'm glad that you are here. And first of all, before we even get going on anything, congratulations on kicking cancer, brother man. I know that that's not always an easy feat to do. So my hat is off to you, man. I'm so glad that you're here with us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to share my story.
Let's get into it, because when you got that diagnosis, you were only 34 years old, which, believe it or not, I believe is right about the average age for when a man will be diagnosed with testicular cancer. Nonetheless, that's still so young. I would imagine that really caught you off guard.
It did. Yep. It was pretty shocking, I must say. And, you know, I had a 2.5-year-old daughter. And basically this came out of nowhere. I woke up one morning and it basically felt like someone had kicked me in the, you know what, and I had just had immense pain. I knew something was wrong, and we dropped our daughter off at daycare, and my wife and I just went directly to the emergency room. And within an hour that I had a diagnosis. So they knew exactly what it was. They said, this is what it is. They did an ultrasound, and that was pretty much it. And within 48 hours, I was prepping for surgery. That's how fast this actually happened. I got an appointment the next day at Sloan Kettering in the city, in New York City. And I live in New York, so we're close to that hospital. And that was it. And I wanted it out as quickly and as easily as possible. And so,
how advanced was the cancer when they found it?
That's a good question. So the first surgery I had was orchiectomy. So that was to remove the testicle that had the cancer in it. And that was a pretty minor surgery. It basically was similar to having a hernia surgery. So they make a little, very, very small incision in your groin area, and they just literally just pull out the testicle. They weren't able to stage it from that surgery. So the plan was, from once you take that out, you're basically doing blood tests every week or two for a few months to make sure that the tumor markers in your blood are actually going down. And so that was what happened. Once the tumor markers normalized to basically zero, they then suggested that I have another surgery, which was, it's called a RPLMD, retroperitoneal dissection something. And so that's the surgery that allows them to stage the cancer and basically remove all of the lymph nodes that it could have possibly spread to. It was an optional surgery. So, you know, I could have decided just not to do it and then just wait and just basically just see what happens. But they encouraged me to get it done just for peace of mind. And so I opted to do that. And that surgery was a very invasive surgery. I was out of work for about 3 months, because they cut your entire abdomen from your sternum. So I have a scar right from your sternum, right on your chest, all the way down around your belly button, all the way down to your groin area. And they basically take your intestines out of your body. They place them on the operating table, and then they go to the back of your abdomen cavity, and they remove all of the lymph nodes, and then they test those. And so that is, and it was like hundreds of lymph nodes that they removed. And so thankfully, when they tested all of that, they had said it had not spread. They didn't see any signs of cancer there, which means it was stage 1A, I believe. And so I did not need chemo, and that was what they wanted to see. If they had seen some other cancer anywhere else, the next step would have been chemo.
That sounds terribly invasive. What are the long-term risks associated with that? I mean, you literally just talked about having them take your intestines out of your body, putting them on the operating table, and then removing, you said, like a hundred or so lymph nodes. I mean, what are the long-term risk potential complications that the doctors told you about?
So there weren't complications, thank God. But the risks were, scar tissue. So there's there's some scarring because they handle the intestines. There's some scar tissue that develops. And so for a certain amount of time, I was not able to eat nuts, seeds, popcorn, carbonated water, anything that would like sort of disrupt the intestine area, where it took a while to get back to normal. I could not have any fat whatsoever. So like zero fat in my diet for about 2 months afterwards. And that was actually really, really difficult. I got to a point where I was like crying for food that had fat in it, because the body, as we know, the body does need fat. It doesn't need a lot, but it does need some fat. And so that was rough. The fact that they cut my abs, my core, my entire core was the muscles were sliced. So I had to rehab that. It was hard to get out of the bed, for a while. And, you know, it was basically, they basically said, walk as much as you can.
So when I had my weight loss surgery, it wasn't done laparoscopically. They actually opened up my abdominal wall as well. And I always found that to be the most painful part of the entire procedure. It's like people don't realize just how engaged your core is in literally every movement that you do. And so I remember waking up from that surgery and just feeling like I had been hit by a truck. And, I just, honestly, Rob, you know, I don't ever feel like my abs quite got back to what they once were, man, but I'm hoping that with your level of activity, because you turned into quite the runner, perhaps your story might be a little bit different than mine turned out to be. How long did it take to rehab that entire area? Do you feel like you're pretty well back to normal there?
Yes. I am, and I was just talking to my wife about 10 minutes before I got on here. I am in 100% the best shape of my entire life. Today, I am in the best shape of my life. And it started from that bed. When I was in the hospital, I told my wife, I am going to do the New York City Marathon. As soon as I get out of here, I'm doing the New York City Marathon. And so that was in 2017. So we're going on 6 years. Almost seven. It's coming up on seven in April. And I am actually running the New York City Marathon. Today is Friday. I am running the New York City Marathon on Sunday. This coming Sunday, I am finally running that race.
Okay, hold on. So there's no way that this interview is actually going to be released before the marathon, but I'm just curious, because here we are about 48 hours from the big race. How are you feeling, man? Are you nervous? You excited? Like that's a long distance to be running, brother.
Very excited. It's basically a victory lap. I mean, I'm an Ironman, so I've done a bunch of Ironman races. 3 70.3s, which is a half Ironman. I did a full Ironman last July in Lake Placid. So that's 2.4 mile swim, and then a 60 mile bike ride. And then after that, a full Ironman marathon, which is 26.2 miles running. So this is just the standalone marathon, which is 26.2 miles through New York City, which is where I grew up. It's basically a 26.2 mile block party where you're running for a couple hours with tens of thousands of people cheering for you. So it's going to be fun.
No doubt, man. No doubt. What do you think it's going to be like when you cross the finish line that day?
I think it'll probably be emotional. There'll be some tears maybe holding back, but it's going to be a good day.
No doubt about it. I want to turn back to your cancer diagnosis here. In doing research for the interview, I was looking at, you know, what are some typical causes of testicular cancer? And there were a number of different things listed on there. Didn't necessarily see diet, though, among them, unlike a lot of other cancers that we talk about here on the show. When you think back at what may have caused this to pop up for you, what does your mind gravitate toward?
It's a good question, and it's really impossible to know for sure. But there is a couple of, there are a couple of theories that I have. So one theory is when my grandmother was trying to get pregnant with my mom and my aunt, she was taking some medication that has since been shown to cause birth defects and issues in the sexual reproduction organs of their offspring. So it's possible it came from that. I know my mother had issues actually getting pregnant, and so I'm an only child. And so that's one possibility. The second possibility that really came into my mind is when I was in high school, I worked at a photo developing place, like at the drugstore at Genevieve's. And so I developed photos and I handled all of those chemicals. And I probably wasn't as careful as I should have been with all the gloves and all that stuff. So I don't know. I mean, those are really the only two things that popped into my mind.
Yeah, I got you. What about other cancers in your family? Does cancer tend to run in your family? Do you think that there could be some other sort of genetic component happening there?
It's certainly possible. So my grandmother, that same grandmother on my mother's side, had breast cancer. And we're also sort of, she blamed it on that medication that she took, because she had a lot of friends that actually had it also that were taking that medication. And she had a radical mastectomy and caught it early. And thankfully she lived. My mother was, I think, 9 or 10 years old when this happened. So, and she lived to a ripe old age of 84. So, and she was about 40 when she was diagnosed. My grandfather on my father's side, unfortunately passed away from multiple myeloma in the mid 80s when I was about 2 or 3 years old. So I don't even remember him that much. So, I mean, there is a history of cancer, but that's pretty standard for, you know, just the standard, I want to say standard American diet, but it's just a standard American health situation that we're in.
Very, very much so. I think that virtually everybody who's listening right now might be able to relate, or at the very least, they know families like yours, like mine, who have just, a lot of people have been touched by that big C word there. Nonetheless, though, I mean, 34 is still such a young age. I know not necessarily so much for testicular cancer, but that probably was like the last thing that was on your mind that was going to happen to you that day when you woke up that morning.
Yeah. And they actually said that it's unusual that I hadn't had any symptoms prior to that. A lot of times there's something. And actually they also said that a lot of times you don't even feel it. There's not like a pain in that pain that comes with it. It's just like a tumor that feels like a pea on it. But somehow it manifested itself that way. And I was able to catch it relatively early. Thank God.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, probably if things would have played out a little bit differently when they took a look at your lymph nodes, it may have been a different situation if you didn't get this addressed so quickly. So in that regard, my man, I'm really happy for you that things shook out the way that they did. I also, Rob, think that having such a traumatic event like that occur with your health would take you a moment, you would take stock of where you truly were in terms of how you've been living, what you've been eating. Are you taking good enough care of yourself? Did you have that moment where you really did kind of take stock of where you were at that point?
I did. And
what was the assessment?
I can credit my parents actually to introducing me to the China study. And they didn't even really know what it was. They were just looking for anything, right? Because their only son had just been diagnosed with cancer, and they're like, we got to do something, right? You got to do something to take charge of your health and not just allow this to happen. So while I was home in between the two surgeries that I had, so I was diagnosed in April of 2017. I had surgery at the end of April. I didn't have the second surgery that second big surgery until June. And I was on leave. I was home. I was able to take full paid leave from my job. And I was home from April until September of that year. The month of May. So it's May of 2017. And that's going to be the month that really changed my life for the good. But I was never the same after I was home. So I looked at everything. I looked at all types of diets, keto, you know, all the fad diets. There's something called the Gerson cancer therapy. So it's like a non-toxic cancer therapy. A lot of it is involved with nutrition and food, but there's also like, they have like special type of coffee enemas and other things that are supposed to be natural and to help cancer. So I was looking at that. That's actually how I started looking into nutrition. I had hired a health coach that was specifically aligned with the Gerson technique. And she is the one who told me to stop eating animal products. Now, I read the entire China study book from cover to cover, and I am a data person. You know, I have a science background. I'm a computer scientist. And as soon as I read in the China study that Dr. Campbell was able to literally reverse cancer, turn it on and off by simply removing and adding the casein protein, which is dairy, basically. So at that point, I immediately stopped eating dairy. So I was like 2 weeks into cancer and I stopped eating dairy. And chicken and meat and all that stuff. I stopped eating all of it. And that is how it started. That is really how it started. And it went down a very, very long, long and convoluted rabbit hole until I'm talking to you, Chuck, 6.5 years later.
Oh, what a rabbit hole, man. We're going to cover those 6 years. Don't you worry. But dairy, right before I went plant-based, that was like one of the last things that I gave up. And I was drinking well over a half a gallon of milk a day. I just loved it. Were you hooked on dairy as well? Were you a dairy junkie? How much were you taking in?
I think most people don't even realize how much dairy they're actually taking in. So even if someone says, "Oh, I'm going to stop eating dairy," like, okay, I'll stop drinking milk, and maybe I won't have cheese. But if you eat anything that comes out of a box, almost anything, like 99.8% of processed food that comes out of a box has some type form of dairy in it. Now, there's a lot of vegan products now, just in the last maybe 2 years that they're marketing because there's an audience for it now, but you know, back then, anything that came out of a box has dairy in it.
It really does, man. It can be tricky, especially as you're just getting going and you're trying to navigate these whole food plant-based waters and trying to figure out how do you do this.
Right, and there's just so many names for it as well.
Oh yeah,
you just have to know what you're looking for. You know, it's a steep learning curve, and that is. For most people, and I run 21 day jump starts with Plant Power in Metro New York. So I'm a mentor for these people that are trying to take charge of their health, and they're doing this. They're making this change for 21 days, and we guide them through it on how to go food shopping and how to cook, what to look for on the labels, how to read the labels. How to read the labels with the amount of sodium, the percentage of sodium that you have with the one-to-one relationship. And there's a lot. It's a lot. It's definitely a lot. It's hard to take and you have to go one step at a time. But in terms of the dairy, I agree with you, Chuck. That is probably the hardest thing to get rid of. Easiest thing for me was meat. And I was a steak eater. I mean, I loved steak. I loved a good steak. I would, you know, on my birthday every year for 15 years, probably on my birthday, I was at Peter Luger's or one of the expensive steakhouses in the city. And we went out for steak every year. But surprisingly, that was easy to get rid of. That the chicken, the beef, very easy. I have no cravings for that whatsoever.
You know, and I wish I could say that your story is unique, but I think a lot of people find it to be very similar in that regard. I do not miss meat to this day. I have absolutely lost my taste for it, although it is kind of funny to hear the name Peter Luger's. I haven't even thought about that place in forever. But yeah, meat was so easy to give up compared to the dairy. The dairy is what I craved, yep. Man.
And it's still, I still have issues with the pizza.
You know, sure.
The smell of a good pizza.
Oh, dude, and you're living in New York? Forget about it, man. Forget about it. You know, New York, I'm sorry, every other city, but New York is the pizza capital of the world, hands down. And you will never convince me otherwise. You mentioned when you were home recovering in that first month, you were looking at all different kinds of diets. And you mentioned like you couldn't eat fat for so long. And yet you were looking at the keto diet as one of the possibilities. That must have been torturous for you because that is a notoriously high fat diet that in those days, at least, you were in no position to even attempt to eat, right?
No, there was no way. There was no way I could even do it. And actually, it was a blessing that I wasn't able to eat the fat because I didn't even try it. And I got far enough along with Dr. Campbell and then Dr. Barnard and you know, Dr. Greger, everyone that I was convinced by the hard data and the science that this is the way to go. And the best part about it is as long as you're eating the right foods, you can eat as much as you want and stay the same weight. And your weight will eventually just equalize to what your body is supposed to be. It might take a couple of years if you've been eating the standard American diet, but I mean, I eat ad libitum to as much as I want. And I work out a lot, I exercise, and I eat a lot. And you know, I just eat a lot of, it's high carb, low fat. That's what it is. It's a lot of potatoes. It's a lot of grains. It's a lot of delicious sauces that you make,
but you're not counting calories though. It doesn't sound like.
Nope. Not at all.
Just eat until you're full and that's it. And when you're hungry again, eat some more, call it good. I like that, man. And I find that especially for people who have lost weight, myself included, to keep it off, that is a sweet, sweet thing to have in your pocket to know that you're not on one of those diets where you only have a certain allotment of calories that you can eat in a day. And you know, they've concocted this system where you can blow them all on one indulgence and still be okay. But then what the heck are you going to eat the rest of the day? You're starving. So suddenly that slice of cake that was okay just isn't worth it anymore. So I love this idea of just eat until you're full and then you're good to go. And it is. It's a different kind of full, right? I mean, eating what you eat today versus when you went to your birthday dinners at the steakhouse and you walked out and you probably felt a lot different after eating that meal than you do even on the most plant-based of Thanksgiving dinners.
Right. It's a very different kind of full. I mean, and I think most people don't realize most people have never experienced the type of full that does not come with inflammation and with lethargy and just basically that how every American just thinks they're going to feel after Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving afternoon. And they just, it's like they want to feel like that, but I don't know if they want to, but they want to experience the joy of eating all their favorite foods. And then they just accept that they're going to feel like garbage for the next 3 days, basically.
So let me ask you this. You gravitate eventually toward a whole food plant-based diet after a health scare. Nonetheless, I mean, that's still such a radical shift in the way that the average person eats. How did your family react to your decision to go down the plant-based rabbit hole?
So it took a while. It definitely took some time. I remember the day I decided I wasn't going to eat any meat specifically, and I was afraid to tell my wife, and I didn't tell my wife, and she had made these her famous, you know, the turkey meatballs with the sweet and sour sauce that we always love, and she made it, and I had it on over pasta, and I was just like picking at the pasta and trying not to eat the meat, and she said, "What are you doing?" And so I told her, I said, I was reading this book, and I think I'm going to try, you know, going not eating meat. And then, so she's like, she was actually on board with that. She was happy. She's like, why didn't you tell me? I'd be like, because you made the food and I didn't want you to feel bad. But she had been vegetarian on and off in college. And then even when I met her, she was trying it. I made fun of her a little bit for it at some point. But this was vegetarian. So she had dabbled in vegetarianism. So she said, okay, she'll be vegetarian. And so she was vegetarian for, she watched me go from vegetarian and then to vegan and then to no oil, whole food, plant meat. She watched me go the full gamut over about, I became more strict over the course of like maybe a year and a half to 2 years after that. And even when I started like really being a triathlete, when I was training, that was when I really got into it in 2019, early 2019. So it took about, I'm trying to think of when it was after the pandemic that she went full on. So she went full in 2021. So the summer of 2021. So it took about 3 years of her watching me do this for her to fully become on board.
Was it hard for you being the only one who was fully on board in the house?
It wasn't easy per se.
Because the reason why I ask is there are a lot of people who I hear from, a lot of the exam roomies are like, I'm the only one. I'm the only one in my house. And sometimes even my spouse will, you know, give me a hard time about it. So yeah. I'm just curious, like what kind of advice you might be able to offer someone who's in that position.
So I learned how to cook. I went to online cooking school at Ruby. I took the plant-based cooking course with them, and then I went a step further and took the professional plant-based cooking course with them. And then I went even further than that and I'm just now finishing up becoming a Food for Life instructor with PCRM. So, but really is if the only way to succeed at this is to make your own food and know what's going into it. And so most of the time I would make food and my wife and daughter would eat it. The only thing that really they did not cut out completely was dairy and everything else we were eating the same or like processed food and, you know, snack food and stuff like that. But it's, and that's what the dairy, that's where the dairy came from. And sometimes pizza, you know, pizza is very, very, especially as a kid, right? I mean, my daughter's going to birthday parties. And she says she's vegan, right? And then when she goes to a birthday party, she's like, I'm not vegan for 2 hours. I'm having a slice of pizza. And well, she's nine and she understands she's pretty good. She eats very, very healthy. And she always goes for the veggies and the fruit first. Basically you just crowd out all the other stuff. And if you have a little bit of it, it is what it is.
Yeah, you're not the only parent who I've heard takes that approach and says something to that effect. 'Cause you can only control what you can control, and those are, you know, within the walls of your home by and large. Right. But you always have those open conversations with the kid and arm them with that education so that, you know, they can make their own informed decision when those times do come, and they certainly do. So, yeah, you're certainly not the only parents to be doing it that way. And yeah. And in New York, man, again with the pizza, that's a hard one. By the way, are there any like what are the top-notch vegan pizza places in New York? I would imagine there have to be some that are just amazing.
So, you can go to any pizza place in New York and order a pizza vegan. Because I don't eat the vegan cheese because it has all the coconut oil and stuff that I don't want to eat. I basically order a pie with extra sauce and every veggie that they have. That's how I order it. I say, give me every vegetable that you have and pineapple and extra sauce on a large pie. And then I eat until I'm full. And it's usually four or five slices.
All right. Hold on. Like, now we have to talk about this debate of pineapple being a bona fide pizza topping. This is about as divisive as politics. You are either pro-pineapple or you are anti-pineapple and say it has no business on top of this particular pie. I am a pro-pineapple guy and have been even long before I was eating a plant-based diet. I will argue to the death that pineapple is a fantastic pizza topping. And as a matter of fact, you can give me the cheeseless pizza with pineapple and pineapple only, and I'm going to be good to go. Why? Because pineapple is delicious, and don't you ever forget it, my friends. And that's all I have to say about that, Rob.
Agreed. 100% agreed. We've ordered pizza with just pineapple and mushroom and sauce. That we've done that before.
Yo, pineapple mushroom.
And then I like to throw on chopped olives. They usually don't have that, but I do it myself. And my wife doesn't like olives, so we can't like order it like that. But olives on pizza are just unbelievable. You get a little bit of the saltiness. You get the fat from it. It's delicious. And if you put it with pineapple, then you get the salt and the sweet.
I was just going to say, it's like you've just created a flavor explosion, man. That's why people like the Hawaiian pizza. You know, if they're not vegan, they like the ham and pineapple because there's your sweet, it's your salt, fat. And your fat, man. So you're hitting the trifecta. But you do it at plant-based. You replace the ham with the olives. Broccoli, Rob, for the win. Dude, you have blown some minds right now, Rob. Man, well done.
And if you put some cashew cheese on there, that's for extra credit. If you want to make some cashew cheese. But that depends if you're eating nuts or not. But I mean, you basically just throw in a cup of cashews with water and lemon juice and garlic, fresh garlic cloves, and you just blend that up. It becomes a creamy ricotta, basically. You just throw that, you just dribble it right onto the pizza. Delicious. You can make baked ziti with that too.
Rob.
I'm actually making that tonight, so I'm loading up. I'm carb loading tonight.
But hold on, do you really even need to carb load as many carbs as you're eating these days? I mean, isn't it a little bit different?
It is. It's definitely different. I don't need to. You're absolutely right, Chuck. I do not need to.
But delicious.
I want to fit in. Let's say that. I'm eating my pasta. It's whole wheat pasta, but I'm eating it and I'm eating a lot of it.
It's all good, man.
With the cashew cheese and the sauce and the garlic.
Would you go so far as to maybe do olives and pineapple in pasta? Like, I almost think that could win. It sounds weird, but the flavor profile I think is there.
You know, I've never tried that. That is a good idea. I think I might try that tonight.
Yeah. Again, weird. You're going to have to get over the strangeness of it, but I do think that there's going to be a payoff at that finish line for sure.
And I'll throw some hot sauce on there too for good measure.
Right? Rob, next level, Rob. Next level, buddy. You and me, simpatico when it comes to that stuff. I love where your mind is at. Question for you here. When did you decide that it was time to get up, lace up the old sneakers and start going for runs, and not just runs around the block, but friggin' ultra marathons, Ironmans, the New York City marathon? When did you get into being super fit, man?
So I when I was in the hospital, I told my wife, I'm going to do this marathon. And the rehab was, so I had to, while I was even in the hospital, I was in the hospital for about 5-6 days, and they had me walking around the floor, basically. It was like a loop, and I was pushing my IV cart and I was walking. And they said, walk as much as you can. And then in order to leave the hospital, I had to walk up a flight of stairs, which was very painful. And I had like two PT guys like holding me up, and we were walking, and I finally got to the top and they said, you can go home. But I started walking. That's the point. And while I was recovering that entire summer, all I was doing was walking. I got a Fitbit. I was counting my steps. I was competing with my friends. I was doing like, 20,000 steps a day, walking. And then I just started running from there. It started, I just never stopped, basically. I went back to work that fall, and then I said, okay, I am going to, I said to myself, the New York City Marathon, that's the 26-mile run. That sounds hard. Why don't I, and I always had a thing for triathlon. I used to watch it as a kid, and I'm like, why don't I try a short triathlon instead? Because that's only a sprint triathlon. That's a half a mile swim, and then it's a 12-mile bike ride, 12 or 15-mile bike ride, depending on the race. And then it's only a 5K, which is 3 miles. I can walk 3 miles. I've been walking 10 miles a day. I can walk 3 miles if I had to at the end, if I was tired. So, and again, my parents. So my dad actually found me a coach. He knew someone from the gym that he was working out in, that was a coach, that was a triathlete. And so he gave me his number. I called him up. This was in April of 2018. I said, I just had cancer a year ago. My doctors cleared me. I want to do a sprint triathlon. I'm looking at a sprint triathlon in July. This is April. Can you get me there? He's like, okay. So I hired him, and I've been with him ever since. And I basically went from that sprint in July. I fell in love with triathlon at that day. I immediately signed up that same day for an Olympic distance, which is double the sprint. And I did that in that September in Westchester, New York. So that the Olympic distance is, it's a half a mile swim, or it's like 0.7 mile swim. And then it's a 30 mile bike ride. And then it's a 10K at the end of that, which is about 6 miles. So I did that race. And then I was like, really, like, okay. So then he said, you're going to qualify. In order to qualify for New York City, and I told him this was my goal, I wanted to run the New York City Marathon, you need to run 9 New York Roadrunner races in New York the year before, and then you have to volunteer for another one. They call it the 9+1 program. And so I started doing that. So I basically started running all of these races just in order to get the to basically be able to register for the New York City Marathon in 2020, to have the privilege of paying for guaranteed entry into New York City Marathon.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but I think that the payoff's going to come for you. And when you cross that finish line, it's going to be an emotional thing, man. And I do wish you all the best of luck with that race. And the last question that I have for you here is two. Number one, where do things stand with your cancer today? Are you still getting screened? Are they still looking at your blood? What's going on there?
So I am cancer free.
Good deals.
They've never actually said the word remission. I've never even asked them that. But it basically, I was 6 years ago, I was going once a month. So basically once a month, I would get blood work done, and then they would do a chest x-ray, because sometimes if it comes back, it sometimes manifests itself in the lung. So they do a chest x-ray. So they were doing that once a month for a year. And then the second year they were doing it every 2 months. And then the third year, every 3 months, and so on and so forth. And so at this point, I'm doing it once a year. And so once a year in the summer, I just go for my blood work and my chest x-ray, and that's it. That's what it is. And I just asked them this year, I said, when do I stop doing this? And they actually said, you do it for the rest of your life, because it's possible that it comes back. So, and again, the way I'm eating, I don't think I'm very confident it's not coming back.
But. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, absolutely. Fingers crossed for you there, man. You're certainly taking all the right steps, and taking quite a few steps, man. We're talking marathons and 20,000 steps a day walking. Like, you're a step guy for sure. And just curious, like, on your blood work, have you been able also, since you made this transition to the whole food plant-based diet, have you been able to look at other things like your cholesterol, maybe even blood pressure, things like that? That's not necessarily blood work, but, you know, your other biomarkers. Have you noticed a difference?
Yes, definitely. My cholesterol is probably 180, maybe close to 200 at some point before I was eating like this, and now it's like 140. 130 sometimes, depends on the year, but it's in the healthy range. Heart is great. Blood pressure is decent. Yeah, we're good.
So you're feeling good, man. You're feeling good. You're looking good. You're out there running your patootie off, dude. You know, I'm just so thrilled to have had this time for you. And, you know, what's the last thing is, you know, what advice might you have for somebody who is in their late 20s, early 30s, or maybe, you know, even a little bit older, but you're a guy and you think something's just not quite right down there. What would your message be to that person?
Get it checked out immediately. It doesn't hurt to just ask the doctor. A lot of times it's nothing. And most of the time it probably is. It's a relatively rare form of cancer. So, but it's better to check than to let it grow, because that's the worst thing that'll happen.
Well, my friend, you are a shining example of how it should be done, how it could be done, and just what the end result could be. Because I think that you have come out of this whole ordeal healthier than you have ever been in your entire life, as you said. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And thank you for everything that you're doing with Plant Powered Metro New York. And welcome, my friend, to the Food for Life team as well. Dude, you are going to be a rock star of an instructor, man. I'm so glad that you're part of the team.
Thanks, Chuck. It's a pleasure.
Great update from Rob. He tells us that he did fantastic in the marathon, triumphant, finished like a champion, just as he did in the Ironman. Such a surreal story of a well-run journey back to health. So Broccoli Rob, my hat is off to you. You are the man. Now, let's talk a little bit more about testicular cancer. It's actually not considered to be a common form of the disease. That's according to the American Cancer Society, which says only about 1 out of every 250 men will develop it. And the average age of diagnosis is on the younger side, just 33 years old. Only 8% of cases occur in men older than 55, but this is important as well. It can also happen with exceptionally young men. 6% of testicular cancer cases come among children and teenagers. The alarming thing, though, is that we've actually been seeing more and more cases for a while, and the rates of testicular cancer diagnosis, they're up more than 50% over the last half century. But on a positive note, because it is also one of the more treatable forms of cancer, the mortality rate has been falling during that same stretch. And the lifetime risk of dying from testicular cancer is actually only about 1 out of every 5,000. So here's a question that you may be wondering. What does diet have to do with it? Well, research is still being done in this area, but a few studies have found that the risk is higher among men who eat a lot of fat, red meat, and dairy, while the rates are lower among the men who eat more fruits and vegetables. Specifically, one Canadian study concludes that, quote, in particular, dairy products, luncheon meats, and baked goods demonstrated a significant increased trend in risk. Meanwhile, researchers at Harvard say that dairy is the primary dietary connection and cheese is particularly culpable. They also found higher calorie diets increase the risk of cancer risk as well. Now, other factors that influence risk, according to the American Cancer Society, include family history, although experts here say most cases do not have a genetic component. Also influencing risk, having at least one undescended testicle where it has remained in the abdomen instead of falling into the scrotum as normal. Also, having been diagnosed with HIV or cancer in the opposite testicle. Plus, race is a factor, with white, American Indian, and Alaska Native men several times more likely to develop testicular cancer than men of Black, Asian American, or Pacific Island descent. But scientists say they are still working to determine why race could be a factor in this case. Also, the ACS says while many studies have shown body weight to influence other forms of cancer, the evidence to support a connection in this case remains limited. And there are links to some of these studies for you right now in the episode notes. Man, do we have a special treat coming up at the International Conference on Nutrition and Medicine this year. For the first time ever, we have a cooking competition, but not just any cooking competition. What we have is the Healthy Hospital Chef Challenge. And to talk all about that with us today is the one, the only, the incomparable Chef Dustin Harter. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Chuck. Thanks for having me. It's great to see you.
When you said, hey, Chuck, we're doing this at ICNM, I couldn't think of a better game show host to do this. You're a chef. You're a guy that's got personality and energy for days. And what's going to happen is just going to be pure, healthy magic. Tell us about what's coming up.
I can't wait. It's so funny you say that because I'm envisioning myself just running around the ballroom the whole night of the live competition, just trying to get it all documented for everybody and tell the story of these great chefs. We've got applications are open for the Healthy Hospital Chef Challenge. We're encouraging all food service workers in the healthcare arena to apply. That's who's eligible. And you have a chance to win $6,000 at this. So we have a whole review committee reviewing the recipes, and we're testing the recipes as we get the submissions in. And then we'll pick the top three from there, and they're going to compete live Thursday night at ICNM this year on August 15th. We can't wait.
Man, so let's talk qualifications here. This is very exciting. August 15th is the big night. That's going to kick off the conference this year. But what are the qualifications? I'm assuming, obviously, they have to work in a hospital as a chef. What other kind of criteria are we looking for?
So you have to work, as you said, in the hospital, in a healthcare facility, in the food service arena. And the recipe has to meet some requirements in the nutritional analysis field. So that's all listed in the rules and guidelines on the website for that. You can get the specifics of how much fat for the fat content, the sugar, all that sort of stuff like that. So you can reel the recipe in. And we're looking for an entree recipe, essentially, something you could serve in a hospital, but also something that wows the crowd. And they can use a whole host of produce and veggies or tofu and tempeh, all of the good plant-based items that we know and love. This is a plant-based competition, of course. So we're really excited to see the plant-based offerings that these chefs can bring to the table.
And I think that it's really important. It's not that we just want to bring healthier foods to the hospital. I mean, there's a genuine need for this. This isn't just created because we want to have some fun at ICNM, which of course we do. But if you look at the menus that are being served right now at the hospitals, it's really like, this is the same stuff that really brought a lot of these people to the hospital in the first place, Dustin.
Yep, absolutely. And these chefs are at the forefront. They are the leadership bringing plant-based, patient-centered care to these hospitals. So we want to celebrate them. We want to highlight the good work that they're doing within the healthcare field. It's a very difficult field to navigate getting plant-based options on the menu, as you know, which is so mind-blowing still to us, right? But it is a difficult arena to get plant-based options on the menu. And these chefs are really putting up the good fight to do that. So we want to celebrate what they're doing in their communities, and we want to share it with the world, essentially.
So if I were a chef, what I would think is that I would take a look at the menu and I would try to identify what are the items that the patients are ordering the most. And let's just say, you know, it's a ham and cheese sandwich with French fries. Would you be open to somebody creating a healthier version of a sandwich with maybe some baked fries like that? So it's again, kind of tweaking fan favorites, but just giving them healthier versions.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think we're looking for, you could give us a sandwich, but is it going to win is the question, because we're looking for that innovation too. So what is something that's easily accessible to a hospital, but maybe is going to elevate the dish just a little bit to make our awesome judges panel just be wowed by what they're offering at the competition too, because it is a competition at the end of the day. So they could take that and they could do a plant-based version of that ham sandwich, but what are they going to do as the wow factor for it to elevate it as well?
And who are the judges? Because if there's an open seat, I would just love to throw my name in there.
We've got Brooklyn Palmer, Dr. Brooklyn Palmer joining us. So she's in preventative care and she runs Beats by Brooklyn on Instagram. Of course, she's fabulous, and she's going to be talking all about the preventative qualities of ingredients that are being used. We've got Chef Emmett McDonough, who runs culinary development with NYC Health and Hospitals, and they've had plant-based options on their menus for quite some time now, so he's really bringing his expertise in the plant-based world to the judges' table. And we have Chef Sean Medijevich. He's from the Institute of Culinary Education. So we're actually partnering in this competition with the Institute of Culinary Education to really bring that culinary prowess to the table as well. They've got a great plant-based course that they do at the Institute of Culinary Education. And Chef Sean's going to be there to enlighten us on why plants are important, of course, too.
And I'm just saying, I may add a fourth chair. It just might have to happen.
You're
going to
be there. If you're there, you know you're getting fed. You're part of the family.
I mean, come on. It's just got to happen. So here's the deal. You get the $6,000. I think it's also important to note that continuing education credits are available here, too, for those who need it. That's a biggie.
Well, that's great. Let's also talk about what the attendees get, right? So when they come to the competition, they're getting a reception hour where they get to network. They're going to get some past hors d'oeuvres. They're going to get a swag bag. They're going to get some wellness mocktails. But all through the night, they're also getting that continuing education credit as well. And they're getting that because we're making this entertaining, but we're also making it educational. I have a guest host with me, Lillian Correa, also from NYC Health and Hospitals. She's a registered dietitian. She's going to be breaking down those three recipes and telling us why they're healthy, why they're great for a hospital menu, and why every hospital should put them on their menu ultimately. So we've got chefs cooking it up, wowing us away with what they're doing. We've got a registered dietitian breaking down the health benefits, and our awesome judges panel really sharing with the audience different ways they can implement certain things within their institution as well. So we just have a really well-rounded event for the attendees to get a look into the future and see how they can uplift and celebrate their communities from wherever they're coming from as well.
And it's really easy. Tickets are on sale right now, pcrm.org/ICNM to reserve your seat. There's also a link in the episode notes. Or when you go there as well, you can register to sign up to apply to be part of this challenge. If you are a chef and you work in a hospital or a medical setting, I mean, this is the contest of all contests.
Apply to compete. And I want to say too, if you're listening and you know someone you think would be perfect for this challenge, please make sure they get this information. We want everybody to have the opportunity to compete. It's a great cash prize, $6,000 for first place, $2,500 for second place, $1,000 for first place. So every one of the contestants, no one's going home empty-handed, essentially. And the first prize winner also gets a feature in Physicians Committee Good Medicine. They're going to get a continuing education plant-based course from ICE of their choosing, so they get to continue their plant-based education. And they also get a plant-based lunch for their staff of up to 25 people if they win. So we really want people to come out and have fun and compete and battle it out for these great prizes. So share it with everyone you know.
We're going to put them in our magazine, Good Medicine. That's awesome.
Heck yeah. We got to celebrate the good stuff they're doing.
And the lunch. I might have to crash that party too. Chef Dustin Harder, can't wait to see you at ICNM. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
And as we wrap up for today, don't forget to join us in person in Washington, D.C. on March 26th at the National Press Club for the Power Foods Revolution. We're going to be taping a special episode of the podcast with Dr. Neil Barnard, Chef Dustin Harder, and Stephanie Ignafo from Plantspiration. Tickets are on sale now at pcrm.org/events, or you can click that link in the episode notes. Everybody who gets a ticket gets a copy of Dr. Barnard's new book, The Power Foods Diet, that night as well. So pcrm.org/events or the link in the episode notes, March 26th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Also, Saturday, March 23rd at the InterCare Center in Toronto, I'm going to be taping an episode on longevity with the one and only Dr. Michael Greger. This is tied into the tremendous Planted Expo, so we hope to see you the night of Saturday, March 23rd in Toronto. Tickets available right now at plantedlife.com, or again, there's a link in the episode notes. And don't forget to follow or subscribe wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts, whether it be Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you get your shows, leave a 5-star rating and a nice review for The Exam Room by the Physicians Committee. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Broccoli Rob Klein for being here and sharing his incredible story with us. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.